From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, near-death experiences. Well, we start the program with a sad note. Past Coast to Coast guest from the television show The Rifleman, Johnny Crawford, who played the little boy Mark McCain years ago, is dead at the age of 75 years old. Complications from Alzheimer's disease. He was a great guy. Here's what's happening. The U.S. military withdrawal from Afghanistan is now formally underway, according to several U.S. defense officials. Fewer than 100 troops, along with the military equipment, have been moved largely by aircraft to execute President Joe Biden's order to begin the withdrawal process no later than May 1st. In addition, contractors and U.S. government workers are also starting to depart the country. There have been about 2,500 U.S. troops in Afghanistan lately that are openly acknowledged, but several hundred additional operations, special op forces that are not acknowledged, and all of them will depart under the president's orders. Federal agencies are investigating at least two possible incidents on U.S. soil, including one near the White House in November of last year that appears similar to what we've been talking about, those mysterious, invisible attacks that have hit some of our embassies, symptoms for dozens of U.S. personnel abroad. Multiple sources familiar with the matter tell us that while the Pentagon and other agencies probing the matter have reached no clear conclusions on what's happening, the fact that such an attack might have been taking place so close to the White House is particularly alarming. Two deputies in North Carolina have died from their injuries suffered during a more than 13-hour-long standoff at a home near Boone in North Carolina. Three civilians, including the suspected shooter, also died, bringing the death toll to five. Coronavirus patients are increasingly at risk of experiencing a stroke compared to those of similar age who have not contracted the illness, according to a major international study. In many cases, the patients did not present typical symptoms of COVID-19 and were not known to have any pre-existing risk factors. The findings, based on the research of 182 people from 36 countries, were published in the medical journal Stroke. Ocean cruise liners are expected to once again begin sailing out of ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach later this year after being anchored for more than a year by the coronavirus pandemic. But the return of cruise ships to the open seas, which promises to bring in millions of dollars to local economies, isn't without some lingering debate still being played out this month in the nation's capital as they discuss the possibilities of a no-sail order. Captain Kelly Sweeney with us. Kelly, are we going to get these cruises going or not?
Yes, George, we are. Today, the CDC announced that if a cruise ship can show that 98% of the crew and 95% of the passengers on board are vaccinated, they may be approved to sail by mid-July. U.S. cruise ships with fewer than 250 people on board are exempt from these rules. They may resume cruises even before mid-July. And I also have some big maritime news in addition to that, George.
Okay, what do you got for us?
Well, the Biden administration has reversed the Trump policy and announced that all ocean wind energy installations in our waters must employ American mariners. And that's going to guarantee tens of thousands of jobs overall. And I know a couple of my friends are already getting on board with this. It's going to be big money and big jobs for the maritime industry.
I love it. Kelly, thanks for your updates. Always appreciate it. To the lingering damage of COVID-19 infections, add this side effect, too. New research shows that more than half of those sickened by COVID-19 report depression. Among more than 3,900 people who had COVID-19 surveyed between May 2020 and January of 2021, 52% suffered symptoms of major depression, according to researchers. Our resident psychiatrist, Dr. Peter Bregan, with us. Peter, I guess that's normal, isn't it?
Well, it's normal, and it's also fear-mongering. And one of the things I think it's just a good thing to remember is the people who are doing these kind of studies, he's a psychiatrist from my old alma mater up there, Harvard, they're selling diagnoses. They're not saying, hey, folks get distressed during COVID-19, or they're not looking at really what the reasons are that people might get upset. It's since they're modern psychiatrists, they want to make believe that it's a direct result of the disease, so they set up the study that way. But then they have to admit that they can't prove why these people are depressed, and then the measures they're using are very, very poor. They're not actually interviewing anybody or anything like that. So what I'd say is, yes, it's really, really tough right now. But don't get caught in the psychiatric diagnostics. You're depressed, you're anxious, or something like that. And don't get psychiatric drugs. Those are the very same people who are giving us all the fakery around COVID-19. They're the same people that are pushing these dangerous vaccines on us that are very experimental. It's that huge industrial complex that's speaking to you when you hear those things. So what you want to do is take a deep breath and think, maybe there's a whole better way I can approach what's going on in America today. And I'm working, George, with, God, I can't even tell you how many people, and talking to hundreds and hundreds of people, not even considering the millions on your show. And people all over the country are deciding it's time for them to stand up on COVID-19, to say that we're not going to be listening to all these restrictions, to say that we're going to start living a healthy life again, to say that there's no reason not to wear masks when you're outdoors and having a good time, and to fight against their putting us into situations where we're going to have certificates of authenticity of some kind that we don't have COVID or that we've gotten the vaccine before we can go watch a ball game or travel or anything. It is a time of huge opportunity because it's never been clearer that American principles of liberty and loving one another are at stake. I mean, the whole way they've closed us off in the masks, it's really a way of isolating us and taking away our liberty, and we don't fight back because we're docile. And as I've been doing this, George, even at my age, I have more wonderful friends now than I have ever had. There are so many people in so many different organizations and groups who are trying to help out from, you know, just volunteering to help people who are isolated and alone and do things like that. But also the people who are saying, let's become Americans again. Let's be proud of America. Let's say we're exceptional. And I think we have the opportunity to be a generation of the founders, George. I'm beginning to call us the refounders of America. Because we really just need to get together now and say no more to humiliating us, no more to putting us down, and stop giving us psychiatric diagnoses. We don't need them.
We'll get there. Peter, thank you so much. Dr. Peter Bregan. You probably have heard of cancel culture, right? Cancel culture is when someone is thrust out of social or professional circles, whether it be online, on social media, or in person. And those who are subject to this are said to have been canceled. The expression cancel culture has mostly the negative connotations and is commonly used in debates on free speech and censorship as well. In a moment, Dan Kovalik back with us. His latest work, Cancel This Book, The Progressive Case Against Cancel Culture. He's next with us on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Dan Kovalik with us, currently teaches international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. Graduated from Columbia University School of Law back in 1993. He then served as in-house counsel for United Steelworkers, AFL-CIO, until 2019. Mr. Kovalik received the David W. Mills Mentoring Fellowship from Stanford University School of Law, was the recipient of the Project Censored Award for his article exposing the unprecedented killing of trade unionists in Colombia, and has written extensively on the issue of international human rights and U.S. foreign policy for the Huffington Post, Counterpunch, and he's back on Coast to Coast. David, Daniel, good to have you with us.
George, always a pleasure. Thank you.
How have you been?
I've been great. You know, I actually had COVID, a fairly mild case. I'm okay now, and, back on my feet.
Did you have those typical symptoms, loss of smell and taste and everything else?
I didn't have that. I had basically flu symptoms for about 2 weeks, so it wasn't terrible.
Well, I'm glad you're okay, and it's a strange situation. This phrase, cancel culture, is it relatively new?
It is a fairly new phrase. In fact, it's something that I hadn't even heard of really 2 years or more ago. It's not something I either heard of or paid attention to, but it's something that has really taken off as a phenomenon in the last couple of years. I think the use of social media has really accelerated it.
I gave kind of a cursory definition of it, but let's get your thoughts. What is cancel culture?
Yeah, well, I think you defined it well. It is a phenomenon in which someone either does or says something which is deemed offensive. Usually it's something that's deemed either racist or sexist. It usually that's a common thing people are canceled for. And what happens is, and it can happen very quickly, someone may say something, a stray remark, as we call it, either on Twitter or Facebook, and people quickly jump to respond to that person on social media, to attack them, to call for them sometimes to be fired or for them to lose some sort of status, or, for example, to be possibly thrown off the social media account they're on,
mm-hmm,
Twitter or
right.
Facebook. Yeah.
Or banned. They ban them for a couple weeks or something like that.
Ban them for a couple weeks, or sometimes they call for them to be banned permanently.
True.
And then this is – it's very typical to happen. The place where this really is at peak levels is in the academy, at the university. Students calling for professors to be fired for all sorts of things. There was the bizarre case last summer where there was a professor – who people thought fell asleep during a Zoom call about racial diversity. She claimed she was just resting her eyes. But in any case, the claim was she fell asleep during this Zoom call, and a student said that showed racial insensitivity and that she should be fired. You know, so it could be the smallest of infractions, or even in that case, arguably not an infraction at all, that could lead for people to call, and many times effectively, for people's discharge.
Dan, are we too sensitive nowadays?
Well, in some ways, I think we are. Or let's put it this way. I think we're too quick. Many people are too quick to judge others for, again, the smallest of missteps. You know, it kind of goes back, you know, for me, someone raised Catholic, it kind of goes back to the Bible. You know, how many times do you forgive? 7 times 70 times. Now we don't forgive even once, right?
Yeah.
If you make one mistake, even though you're an honest, decent person, you could be canceled. And, you know, the other night I was interviewed by a TV station in Seattle, and before we went on air, the anchor told me, she said, you know, we live in fear. Constant fear that we're going to slip up,
yeah,
and get and have people call for us to be fired and get fired, you know. And it's just, that is not a world anyone wants to live in. It's not doesn't come many times from a place of compassion. People will often say, you know, they're doing it in the interest of social justice, but in the end, it's just a cruel act against someone who maybe you could just pick up the phone and say, hey, I don't think that was a cool thing to say, and maybe you ought to rethink that. Instead, they're publicly shamed and again, may lose their livelihood.
Where does hate fit in on something like that? You know, unlike saying spouting off stupid things, what about somebody who's very hateful in social media or dangerously so?
Well, I certainly think that's a different case. And there's a term used pretty often for this called the Overton window, meaning there are lines that can be crossed in which someone may deserve to, you know, have their account suspended or be deplatformed because, yes, they are intentionally trying to harm or to provoke violence or to incite violence.
Or defame or libel or whatever.
Exactly. And certainly when you're on a private platform that is not a government-sponsored platform, you know, you certainly don't have all the First Amendment rights you would have if the government was regulating your speech. You know, Twitter can say, look, I think that crosses the line. This, you know, passes the Overton window, and you should be deplatformed because you're actually engaged in harm. And I think we can argue about where that line is. I think it's not always clear. But I think that many times the cancellation of people happens in the absence of that type of intentional hatred or incitement of violence. That is to say, it's pretty easy for most rational, reasonable people to say, I don't think that is hate speech or violent speech. I think it's much, less than that, and therefore the person should be given the benefit of the doubt.
Would you say in the cases where people are canceled, tossed off of social media, that most of them just made a mistake?
Yes. I mean, and that's what we're seeing. That's what troubles me. Again, it's even arguable that they didn't even make a mistake, that just people disagree with what they're saying. I'll give an example of this. There was a guy, and it's in my book, I'm forgetting his name, but he tweeted out a study, and this was during the protest of last summer. He tweeted out a study, which was done by a person of color, by the way, showing that peaceful protests are more effective than violent protests.
Right.
Okay.
What's wrong with that?
Yes, seems to stand to reason. People called for him to be fired.
Because he said peaceful protests were more acceptable?
Yes.
Jeez.
That's incredible, right? Now, and the book was inspired by a similar event here in Pittsburgh. That's where I live. That's where I'm calling from. Where a peace activist who is a person of nonviolence, on Facebook, she had been a peace activist for 50 years, over 50 years. She tweeted out a meme, which is a photo with a saying. It was a photo of Martin Luther King, and it said, "Never rioted, never looted, change the world." And again, this was a message clearly saying, hey, maybe we should be careful and make sure that the protests we have are peaceful, right? She was immediately attacked on Facebook. People called for her to be deplatformed. And what happened is that the peace and justice group that she co-founded 50 years ago, the Thomas Merton Center, responded by sending out a public letter that they posted on Facebook saying that they would no longer work with this woman. Her name is Molly Rush. Because of this meme, which, by the way, they didn't tell people in the letter what it was. They just said it was racist. They didn't let you decide for yourself whether it was or it wasn't.
Right.
They didn't tell you what it was. And they said because she didn't apologize, when in fact she did apologize. She posted on Facebook that she was sorry for what she posted, which frankly she didn't have to do. I don't think she should have done that in the sense that she had nothing to be sorry for. But again, that's part of this cancel culture. Often an apology is called for, and people will apologize whether they're sorry or not, just to try to save themselves. But in the end, the apology is not accepted anyway. And so they still, to this day, won't work with the very person who helped found their organization based on one meme that she posted on Facebook. And it's that sort of thing that is counterproductive, self-defeating, and frankly just mean. I mean, this woman who I've known for years was obviously devastated by this.
Of course.
So what happened, people who acted, again, claiming to do this in the interest of social justice, did her harm. They did her actual harm, and I don't believe anyone was truly harmed by her meme. And it's those types of cases that really concern me.
We're talking with Dan Kovalik. His latest book is called Cancel This Book. His website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And is it primarily social media, Dan, where people are being canceled?
Well, it's certainly probably the most commonplace because for a few reasons. One, it's easy to do, right? You can do it from your bedroom.
Oh, you just boom and it's done, yeah.
In your fuzzy slippers. And you can largely do it anonymously, right? A lot of accounts, they don't have your real photo. They don't have your real name. So there's no cost to you doing it. There's no risk, right? So that is a common place. But it's not the only place. Again, on college campuses, it's very common for people to come up with petitions to get people fired that they disagree with. Sometimes those are physical petitions on paper, though, again, many are online petitions. So it can take many forms. But certainly social media has made it much easier for this to happen, and to happen so quickly that people don't even really have time to assess what the person has done, if anything, the truth of the allegations against them. I mean, this really violates all notions of due process. That again, what ironically, the left used to, you know, really fight hard for.
And now, hold on for a second, Daniel. We're at a break. We'll come back and talk more about Cancel This Book. Welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Dan Kovalik with us. We'll take calls with Daniel next hour here on Coast to Coast. Dan, what's the process for cancellation on social media? Is there like a committee, one person? How does it work?
Well, and that's the interesting part. No, it tends to be spontaneous. What will happen usually is someone will post something that, again, someone deems offensive or claims to be offensive, whether they even really truly believe that, which has to be, you know, acknowledged that sometimes it's just clear people are there to make trouble. And they will start to attack the person on social media. They'll respond to the statement in question with, you know, very intemperate language. And that encourages other people to jump on. And what happens, you have a mob mentality where people start to jump on to this platform and to attack this person. And people actually get a dopamine rush from that. You know, they actually get excited by doing this. You know, in the old days, you know, people might bring out the pitchfork and torches to mob someone. And again, now you can just do it spontaneously and quickly. And then again, it has a logic of its own, where then someone suggests, oh, well, this person should be fired, and the other people are going to say, yeah, they should be fired. And, you know, the one aspect of the cancel culture is that if you defend this person, which is very important, if you think someone hasn't done something wrong or very wrong, you know, you need to stand up for that person. That can help, you know, kind of calm people down. But most people are afraid to do that because they know that if you defend someone who's being canceled, you yourself can be canceled, right? It's guilt by association.
Right, exactly.
No,
go ahead, finish up.
Well, when I was starting to write this book, in fact, my son said to me, Dad, he says, you know, the surest way to be canceled is to criticize cancel culture, so be careful. And he's right, of course.
What would you say would be the acceptable thing to cancel somebody?
What do you mean?
What would be appropriate that you would be able to utilize to cancel somebody off of social media?
Well, again, I do think, you know, if someone posts something that is hateful, that is overtly racist or sexist, and or incites violence, or actually, you know, in cases when social media is actually used to organize a violent act, then I think you're going down a road where certainly someone opens themselves up to properly being suspended from that platform, you know, and I think most people accept that. What I think is not acceptable is when someone says something which, one, clearly comes from a place of sincerity and good intention, but is said in a way that, again, people don't like. It does, you know, because it doesn't represent the latest.
And almost half the people aren't going to like what you say.
Right. Well, and that's the other thing, you know, but the idea is, you know, we need to listen to other voices, and just because we disagree with them doesn't mean we should call for people's cancellation. And what has happened, of course, is, and this is a very real phenomenon, people are afraid to say what they mean and to say what they think on very important issues of the day. And what happens is you end up having bad results. Again, another example of where cancel culture really came into full force was over the question of lockdowns during COVID. I'm on the liberal to left end of the spectrum, political spectrum. And in that world, if you questioned the lockdowns that were happening, you were called, you know, a granny killer or selfish or whatever. You know, there was a very dogmatic line about the lockdowns where, again, people on the left end of the political spectrum tended to support them uncritically and to judge others who didn't as somehow, again, selfish or reactionary or, you know, or actual killers. And so people, again, in my friendship circles, if they said something like, well, I don't know, you know, it seems to me like maybe you shouldn't shut down the mom and pop stores when you're letting Walmart and the big stores continue to operate unmolested, right? You know, where's the fairness in that? And people would, you know, would get upset about that and attack that person for saying that. So if you question the lockdown, again, many people were attacked for that. Well, there's a case, an interesting case. There's a very smart guy I know well. His name's Mark Crispin Glover. He teaches at NYU. And he actually teaches a case, by the way, on propaganda, okay, which is relevant to this discussion. In the fall, he had a class in which he was questioning the mask mandates. He was saying, look, it's not clear, at least to him, that the masks work. He said that he believed this was more of a means of social control,
right,
the requirement of masks. Now, again, this is a guy teaching on propaganda, so
right.
He felt that this was propagandistic, some of the things that went along with the mask requirements. At the same time, he was telling his students this. He did tell them, but, you know, look, I'm not telling you not to wear the mask. Keep, you know, if the CDC tells you to wear the mask, go ahead and do it. But I'm just telling you that I think we need to question these things and question why we're being told to do these things. Because he questioned the masks, not only students but fellow colleagues at NYU called for him to be fired. And he is fighting hard to keep his job, as we speak.
Try questioning vaccines on social networks. See what happens.
The same thing. And again, you know, we can have a reasonable disagreement. You and I, George. First of all, talking to you is like talking to an old friend. I enjoy it so much. But you and I wouldn't agree on everything, right?
Of course not.
It doesn't mean we can't be friends. It doesn't mean we don't have things to teach each other. And I think it's that, those notions of having honest discussions and real debates that is being lost in all this. And again, the result is bad. You have bad outcomes because you don't have society having robust debates over the most important issues of the day because people are afraid to question things openly and to say what they think.
Are there many defenders of cancel culture?
Well, that's an interesting question. I would say there's not a lot of people who would openly defend it. What is common is for people who support it to deny that it exists at all. That is a common trope, to say, well, this isn't about – one line is this isn't cancel culture. It's making people accountable, right? So they put it that way, and they say there is no real phenomenon of cancel culture, even though, you know, most of our eyes and ears tell us that it does exist, right? So that is a common trope. But there's certainly people that believe, again, that, for example, getting a professor fired for saying something that they find questionable, they see that as a win for the social justice movement somehow. And so, and frankly, you can't blame them because they get a pat on the back for doing it. So those types of folks, yeah, I would say they would defend this cancel culture, but again, they probably would be reluctant to call it such because they know, you know, that it has implications that are not positive.
You know, I just using this as an example, this program, you could say, has cancel culture on it because there are some callers, if they're profane, they don't get on. They're gone. I cancel them. They're out of here. And I guess you could say that's cancel culture, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, first of all, it doesn't have anything to do with what I think is often the phenomenon of cancel culture, where you have really, again, a social media mob that's calling for someone to be canceled. In this case, hey, this is your show, and you can determine who comes on the show or not. And you have certain rules that you set up, and frankly, some are actually enforced by the FCC, right?
Absolutely. That's right.
Off the air if you don't follow those things. Well, then you have a right to be a gatekeeper for those people. I don't see that as cancellation. I see it as, filtering speakers. And again, the other point is, okay, they may not get to talk on your show, but it's not going to impact their job. You're not saying, well, this guy, Charlie, should be fired. Find out where he lives. We should get him fired because he called in and said something profane, right? You're not trying to impact his life. All you're trying to do is to manage your program, which you have every right to do.
Well, which is interesting, Daniel, in our business with the advent of podcasting, which is not regulated. People generally will say anything they want. And then when those same guests come on a commercial radio station, they're thinking, I just said this and that on that podcast. They think they can get away with it. They can't.
Right. And again, I know, as someone who knows how these things work, and again, know that there are rules that the FCC lays down for things that are on the public radio waves. I know if I start dropping the F-bomb, I'm going to have to go, right?
I got to zap you. As much as I don't want to, I have to zap you.
Yeah. And again, that's not a rule that you made. It's a rule the FCC made, and there's a reason for that, too. You have families listening. And again, people can find another forum, as you say, for that.
Well, and you can get your point across without having to use that kind of language.
Well, and in fact, I think people who resort to that type of language probably don't have much of a good argument to begin with, right?
Exactly.
It's a substitute for good argument.
Exactly. Now, back to cancel culture. What in your book, the Cancel This Book, what are you claiming? What would you like to see happen?
Well, I would say that the book is an argument for robust free speech rights, for robust, the ability to have robust debate and discussion. And I believe it's a cautionary tale to say, look, this is not headed in a good direction. And again, it is counterproductive to the goals of many people engaged in this. This is not something that's going to bring about social justice. This is going to turn people off. This is going to upset people. And frankly, again, if you're a progressive and you're engaged in this, you're going to send people fleeing the other way in the other direction politically. And we see this happening all the time. It's an old adage that, you can lure more bees with honey than vinegar. And I think cancel culture is more toxic than vinegar. And instead of using that, we need to deal with others with compassion, even if we disagree with them, to allow people to make mistakes, correct them, of course, if we think that they're mistaken, but do so in a way that is not, again, imposing our will on them or certainly taking away their livelihood. That I find completely unacceptable.
Is cancel culture growing in the United States, or are there still a lot of people that just aren't aware of it?
No, I think it's growing. I think, first of all, it's something now that almost everyone knows something about, and most people know someone that's been canceled. You can come up with just numerous examples of this happening where people were fired after many years at a job. Again, for one mix-up. And I do think this is something new, and it is something that is expanding. I think because now in many circles it's acceptable, and in very elite circles. Again, just to give an example, there was a guy at the New York Times recently who was fired after like 40 years, or he's forced to resign. In any case, he lost his job. And his colleagues called for him to be fired because of the following. On a trip that he had with some students that had nothing to do with his job at the time, Times, some student on the trip was talking about some incident in which someone used the N-word.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't say N-word. They said the whole word, right? And so the guy at the Times, the journalist from the Times or editor, he might have been an editor, he, in order to talk about this incident, himself used that word.
Ah,
right.
Okay.
He quoted it, saying, well, the reason he used the N-word, but again, he used the whole word.
But see, you don't have to use the whole word to get your point across.
Well, exactly. But the point is, because he quoted this student verbatim who said this, I mean, he wasn't saying it out of any racial animus. And again, in an incident away from the newspaper, his colleagues called for him to be fired. And ultimately, he did lose his job as a result. I mean, that's an incredible thing, right? And again, we see that more and more. There was a guy, a professor in the University of California system, I think. He taught Japanese, and there's a word, I guess, in Japanese called nige, which means it's kind of a transitional word, like well or so. And because it sounded too much like the N-word, students called for him to be fired. I mean, this is how absurd this has become. And again, it seems acceptable. And again, students and others feel, you know, entitled to be able to do this and to wield this power over people.
A lot of sensitivities, Daniel. Lots of sensitivities. Yeah. We're going to take a break and come back and take calls. I also want to talk about the Harper's letter that appeared in the Harper's magazine to have you explain that and what that meant. It was a letter on justice and open debate. We'll get your take on that as well. Daniel Kovalik, our special guest, his book is called Cancel This Book. His website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. When we come back in a moment, we'll dive into your phone calls. And if you've been canceled from social media, check in with us as well.